I'm looking for a volunteer for a quiz. They can give me all 28 chapters. Let me try to motivate you. Here we've got all the miracles of the Bible. Who's who in the Bible? Word meanings. 3-volume set on the Trinity. 2-volume set on Bible Encyclopedia. 3-volume set on the cults. Let me try to motivate you. It's not that hard. Take it a little bit at a time. You've had 9 weeks to study. They'll be up there next week as well. Let me motivate you. We need to backtrack a little bit because we didn't have a chance to cover chapter 22. Just kind of deal with it in blocks and segments. This is an overview of the book of Acts. We're not going to go into a lot of detail, simply trying to do an overview. We're going to try to cover up to chapter 25 today. So we're going to be moving at a fairly good pace. But I just realized we still have 2 more weeks after this. So that's great. We're doing good. In chapter 22, we've got Paul's defense before the mob. Here he recalls his conversion. You'll notice that in Paul encountering his conversion, he gives certain details in chapter 9, he gives certain details in chapter 19, and certain details in chapter 22. Just real important for you to look at what the details are, because some of the details, like he'll include one thing here, but not over here. Just pay attention to the details, because every single word is important. In verses 17 to 21, the Lord warns Paul to leave Jerusalem and go to the Gentiles. Let me ask a question. We've dealt with this before. We divided the book of Acts into 2 sections. Anybody remember what they were? Chapters 1 to 12, chapters 13 to 28. Who was the main central figure in chapter 1 to 12? Peter. Who is Peter's primary ministry too? Why is that important? Why is that important? You guys are overanalyzing it, overthinking it. It's real simple. I want you to think of one central point. What was John the Baptist? What was his message? Repentance? And it centered around what? What was John doing when we first saw him? Baptizing. Physical baptism or spiritual baptism? Physical. Is that important, the distinction? Someone said, oh yeah, why? That. What did we say repentance is? Turning away from something to someone. Don't forget that definition. It's key here. It's key here because we're dealing with the physical looking, the physical observation of somebody supposedly doing this, turning from their sin to the living God. We get over here, who's the primary focus? Who is he centering on? Gentiles. What does Paul do as he begins his ministry every single time? Where does he go first? I just put Jews because it's easier to spell out. He goes to the synagogue always. He goes there first, and then later on he goes to the Gentiles. But he always does that. Why? Because he knows these were God's chosen people originally. Okay? What's Paul's message? Same, plus, he says repent, and there's an involvement of spiritual baptism. Why is that key? Why is that different? How is that different from here, from physical baptism? Holy Spirit? Paul always is real specific regarding the gospel. Real specific. Both of them mention the resurrection. Paul just hammers the point home time and time and time again. And he always refers specifically to Jesus. Always. Paul is like, I'm going to get in your face, whether you're a governor, whether you're a regular individual, regardless of who you are, you need to understand the gospel. Paul lays it out real plainly, real specifically, time and time again. In chapter 22, 17 to 21, the Lord tells him, okay, Paul, you're going to leave Jerusalem, and your main focus is going to be Gentiles. Then in verses 22 to 29, Paul's defense is interrupted. Now he must assert his Roman citizenship. Why is that important for Paul? Imagine, if you will, I'm the Apostle Paul. The Jews are after me. They want to string me up. They want me dead. They want to flog me. If the Romans give me to the Jews, guess what? I will not see you tomorrow. Now, what does Paul have to do? He's got to say, whoa, don't hand me over to them. Why? I'm a Roman citizen. I need to go before you guys' tribunal, before your justice system, so you guys can determine whether or not my guilt or my innocence. Because would he receive a fair trial under the Jews? No. No. And then we come to the last portion of our acronym, church. The Council of Sanhedrin. Here, Paul is brought before the Sanhedrin. This gets really, really good. This is what I will call just really meaty stuff. We're going to come across a couple of key figures here. And they're real, I mean, to say they're important is an understatement. One of the key figures we run across in chapter 23 is a person named Ananias. Have we heard that name before? How? Do you remember? Okay. Yeah. This is why Scripture is so important. This is great. I want you to look at or notice the irony here. We've got Ananias. I'm going to say Ananias 1 and 2. At the beginning of Paul's ministry, this Ananias basically does what? He gives Paul his sight. He gives Paul the opportunity to go out there and minister for the Lord. This other Ananias, what does he want to do? Let me give you a little bit of background regarding Ananias. Ananias is described by Josephus in the following way. Insolent, hot-tempered, profane, and greedy. I want you to compare this Ananias with this Ananias. Diametrically opposed to one another. Paul is over here during one Ananias, over here during the other Ananias. One helps him receive a sight, the other one doesn't care anything about Paul. That's just the reality of people, reality of human beings. Paul is brought before the Sanhedrin. Paul appeals before the Pharisees. To me, this is just comical. Let me ask you, what do we know about the Pharisees? What do we know about this group? I'm sorry? They don't believe in the resurrection? They do. What else do they believe in? That's a big one. It's almost kind of comical when we think about it. They believe in the law, yet notice what's occurring here. Here's our situation. The Apostle Paul is before us. I am before him. I'm the one that's going to judge him. I slap him, I beat him, I do all these different things to him, but I'm supposed to be the one handing down the legal system, implementing the law. I've just violated how many of these guys his legal rights? I think it's comical here. They're called the separate ones. They believe in the existence of angels, the resurrection, judgment on the last day, the coming of Messiah. They believe in preserving and keeping the law. Now, this is real important. What's Paul's background? Pharisee. Paul is a genius. There's no way around it. He's a genius. You've got the Pharisees on one side, you've got the Sadducees on the other side. What does Paul do? Divide and conquer. Gotta love it. The Sadducees. They're the modernists. They really valued Greek philosophy. This is key here. They did not believe in the afterlife. They believed that the law must be adapted to modern times and the current state of knowledge. They were the materialists. In other words, let me put it in today's language, the Sadducees are today's TV evangelists. For them, it was all about the dollar. It really was. That's why they were so... They had so much animosity against Christ when Christ came, because what did they think was going to happen? They thought they were going to lose their place of superiority, lose all the wealth, lose all the property, and be like everybody else. Because they believed that everybody was going to follow Jesus Christ. Was Jesus pushing money and property and wealth and all that? Not at all. Not at all. So these guys are scared to death that when Christ came, they were going to lose everything. They were going to lose it all. I want you to notice something else. The dispute and the domino effect of theology, i.e. revelation, why was that so important here? Why is it a domino effect taking place here? The resurrection and revelation. How does one affect the other? Let me explain what I mean by the domino effect. These are my little dominoes here. Okay, not exactly dominoes. But this is the domino effect. If I have... It's my domino of God, domino of revelation. I'm going to get real specific here. The domino of the resurrection, the domino of an afterlife regarding either heaven or hell, and my domino of the Son of God. Now, what does Paul do here? Paul focuses on this issue right here. Because if you deny this issue here, then you bring into question the other issues as well. If I deny the issue of resurrection, I've got to also deny anything regarding the afterlife, whether it be a heaven or a hell. Paul realized that. That's why when you're talking to people, you've got to realize you need to understand what is their worldview. George Bonner kind of put it like this. He said the average Christian out there does not have a Christian worldview. Believe it or not. Believe it or not. If I were to sit down and ask you, what do you believe about God? What do you believe about revelation? I would venture to say I would probably find a percentage, even at this church, that's being taught real well, there's going to be people that don't have a Christian worldview. That's just the way, like we said before, life is. That's why I meant to comment a couple weeks ago that 85% of America claim to be Christian. 85%. What's interesting is, oh, I wonder if I can pull it up. Just a second. Let me see if I can pull up the figures for you. Oh, here we go. not too big, you can't see it. 31% of Christians in America say that God is not all-powerful. 42% say that Jesus committed sins while on earth. Boy, this is really tough to read. Let me find a better one. There we go. 61% say the Holy Spirit is not a person. 54% say believe man receives salvation by works. 46% say Satan is not real. 34% say that it's important to share your faith. Here's the kicker. 98% say that faith is important. I don't know about you, that scares me. If I deny the existence of God, if I deny the existence of the devil, if I deny salvation by grace through faith in Christ alone, and I say faith is important, there's a domino effect there. Important for what? There's always a domino effect. That's why I tell people you got to know your theology well. It ought to feel like a glove. If it doesn't feel like a glove, guess what? You're wrong. God's not wrong, you're wrong. So Paul divides these people over the resurrection. There's a couple other things that are important about the Sadducees. They only believed in the first five books of the Bible, the writings of Moses. That's all they believed in holding on to. I want you to think about that. What other books of the Bible in the Old Testament is Christ or the Messiah central in? Isaiah, Psalms, Proverbs. Matter of fact, in order to be a Pharisee, you had to know inside out, forwards and backwards, the first five books of the Bible. You had to know the Psalms. You had to be familiar with Isaiah, but you had to know the Psalms. What Psalm can you think of offhand that deals with the Messiah? 22? 16, the resurrection? I mean, you can go on and on and on all day long, involve yourself with the Psalms, because it was just that important for the Pharisees to understand who is Messiah. Who is Messiah? So the Pharisees are today's liberals. The Sadducees are today's TV evangelists. And then we get to chapter 23. In verse 11, Paul receives a special grace from the Lord. Now, I got to ask myself this question. This special grace that he received, who is he to console? Is that to console himself? Or is it to console us, the reader? Imagine, if you will, you're the Apostle Paul. You know your time is limited. God has given you special grace because you know that as you go on this journey to that city or to this city, one of those cities you will die in. Who is the grace for? Is it for him? Or is it for us? Or is it for all of us? Then there's a conspiracy to kill Paul. I always giggle when I come across the term elders. When I used to pastor, one of the first things we did was I sat down with the elders and we went through a study on the elders of the church versus the elders of the people / Israel. And it was amazing, the difference. Amazing. Because the elders of the church, the Christian, they were seeking after God. I mean, you see this all through the New Testament. They're seeking after God. They're desiring to teach and preach His Word. But when you look at the other side, the elders of Israel or the elders of the people, you get into sections like in Jeremiah, where God has to warn them to stop drinking beer and get drunk. He has to warn them to stop going to the sanctuary fully inebriated. He has to warn them to stop misusing their powers. We see a big difference between those elders and these elders. When we come here, we see that there's a conspiracy going on. And what do we see again? not the elders of the church, the elders of Israel coming together to kill Paul. In fact, it's kind of interesting when you look at the number of people that are here to do Paul in. He says there were 40 individuals that got together. And what's kind of fascinating here is they've taken an oath. This would be like, don't take this wrong. The jihad of Israel. They think there's honor in doing this. They really do. What's interesting here is this. The verb for taking an oath refers to a person who binds himself under a curse if he does not fulfill that oath. What I find is interesting is this. After they take the oath, they fail the oath, what do they do next? They get an attorney to help get the oath off of them. They realize we place ourselves under a curse. We've got to do something to remove this. They figure, hey, what better way? An attorney. An attorney can do anything. So they get the attorney in. Hopefully the attorney is going to be able to help straighten things out and get this curse off of them. This is just mind-boggling to me that you would even do something like that, that you would actually take an oath to kill somebody violating the Ten Commandments. You got to think through all these different things. You know, there's an old saying. It says, belief is not so much what you believe, but what you do. You can tell me all day long you believe X, Y, Z. But you know what? If I watch your life and your lifestyle contradicts what you believe, your words were unimportant. Your actions became very important. I see from their actions, I see what they truly believe. Remember, they're supposed to be experts in what? The law. Yet what are they doing? They're violating the law constantly. Let me just kind of, in a little parenthesis, point out that here Paul receives his fourth vision. His fourth vision. Let me give you some of the other ones that he receives. We're not going to go through them because we just don't have time, but in chapter 9, verses 4 through 6, that's his first one. Chapter 9, verses 4 through 6. In chapter 16, verse 9, his second one. 16, verse 9. Again, in chapter 18, verses 9 and 10. Those 18, verses 9 and 10. And here, in chapter 23, he has his fourth vision. In verses 23 to 35, Paul is secretly swept away. This is... I almost have to giggle at this, because the question I have is simply this. How the heck are you secretly swept away when there's 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen? How are you secretly swept away? You know what? These guys were experts. They would be the ninjas of today. They literally would be. Who had the greatest fighting force of all time? The Romans. These were masters of death. But what do they do here? They save Paul's life. Here's the irony. Paul was safer with the Romans than he was with the Jews. Think about that. Safer with the Romans than he was with his own people. And what was he trying to do with his own people? Save them. Isn't life ironic at times? That's why it's so hard to witness to your own people, to family. I hear people all the time says, I've been trying to witness to my mom, I've been trying to witness to my dad, I've been trying to witness to my brother, my sister. You know what? It's hard. It's hard. Paul experienced the exact same thing. Then we get to chapter 24. Paul goes before Felix, the governor. In chapter 24, verse 1, we're introduced to the attorney that we mentioned earlier, Tertullus. I hope you're reading this on your own, because to me it's just kind of fascinating what happens here. Here's an attorney who tries to basically flatter Felix. He tries to make... You notice what he'll do here. He tries to say, well, you know, this Christianity, it's just a sect. It's a cult. And he tries to show that Christianity is completely devoid of Judaism. Let me ask a question. What is the difference? I mean, don't go into any big theological... What's the difference between Judaism and Christianity? What? Messiah. That's it. That's the difference. If I was not a Christian, you know what I would be? A Jew. That's the only difference. The Messiah came. And when Messiah came, what did He give us? He gave us fuller revelation of who God is and what I must believe in order to be saved. But that's the difference. Here, Tertullus is trying to say, no. There's a huge difference between these guys. And in fact, this Christianity is really just another sect. And look how he refers to Christianity here. Let me back up. Verse 1. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. And they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this in profound gratitude. But in order not to weary you further, I will request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. Wow. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him. By examining him yourself, you'll be able to learn the truth about all these charges we're bringing against him. He's a troublemaker. He's stirring up riots, dissension all over the world. Man, you think every place in the world knew of Paul? Not at all. Not at all. What he didn't realize that Felix knows about Christianity already. And he knows what a line is. The lawyer is trying to give him a big line. Let me let you know a little bit about Felix. According to early church records and secular records, Felix was known for his violent use of force. He was corrupt, extremely arrogant. What's interesting is this. He used to be a slave that won his freedom. He used to be a slave that won his freedom. What does that tell me? He understands down here and up here. He has seen both sides of the track. He knew about Christianity. So Paul, in verses 10 to 23, gives his defense before Felix. Let me share with you, without reading all that, 7 things that Paul either directly says or alludes to here. First, Paul basically says this. He has not been in Jerusalem long enough to instigate any kind of riot. Now, I have never instigated a riot. I have no plans on doing that. But I would imagine it would take a little bit of time. Paul says, I haven't been there long enough to do something like that. Secondly, he says that nobody could prove that he implemented or instigated any kind of riot. Third, he says that he worships the God of Israel in full conformity with the laws and the prophets. Why is that important? Why is that important here? Paul's worshiping the God of Israel with full conformity to the laws and the prophets. Why is that important? Perfect. Perfect. Everybody hear that? Everybody hear that? Full conformity to the law and the prophets. In other words, what we're saying is this. Like, say it again. Yeah. That's what they say they do. Here we've got Israel. Their primary purpose was to do what for God? What was their primary purpose? What was Israel supposed to be as God's chosen people? Witnesses to the world. And in doing so, they've got to tell the world about God's revelation. That revelation is coming out of the law, the prophet, and the writings. What does Paul say? I'm only doing what you guys are supposed to be doing. You guys gave part of this. I'm giving the whole entire thing. That's why he's in full conformity with the law and the prophets. You guys are giving a little bit of truth. I'm giving the full truth. What is the full truth? All this centers on what? Jesus. All of it centers on him. If you only give this little bit of truth, guess what? You miss this. You miss that. Number four, Paul says that he is not a sect or a cult, but notice how he describes himself. He is a member of the way. The way. Where did he borrow that from? Yeah. They realized exactly who they were following, and they were willing to die for the way. Number five, his hope was in the resurrection, just like his accusers. It's the Pharisees that are bringing Paul up on all these charges, and Paul says, look, my hope is in the resurrection just like you guys. But you know what? For them, for the Pharisees, that was only a small piece of the puzzle. They had to have all of the puzzle in order to be able to understand that the puzzle was, again, central to Christ. Number six, Paul says, in all this, he still has a clear conscience. In all this. Now, keep in mind here, we're almost at the end of Paul's life. Paul has gone through beatings, floggings, scourgings, stonings. Paul has paid a dear price so far. And he has a clear conscience. Why? Because he realized back in Acts chapter 9, when he got that revelation of Jesus Christ, his life was turned around right then. Okay, so now he's got a clear conscience about everything. And then lastly, Paul says, look, my real accusers, the people that are bringing up these charges, they're not even here. They're not even here. If you want to really accuse me, really charge me with all this stuff, bring the people that brought up the charges here with me. I need to see them face to face so you can hear their testimony. So Paul lays out these seven truths to try to say, look, we need to get on the same page. And Felix understands that also well. Felix was neutral. He was neutral. He wasn't really a Pharisee. He wasn't a Sadducee. He was just kind of, I need to sit before you and listen to you. He's a governor. That's all. Chapter 25, Paul goes before Festus. Now, this section here is crucial. One of the main reasons why it's crucial is because here Paul is going to ultimately be going before Caesar. He makes an appeal to Caesar. Let me ask a question. Test your knowledge of history. Who is Caesar at this time? Nero. I don't know about you. I wouldn't want to go before Nero. I mean, just think about Nero for a second. Here's the guy who burns down half of Rome and blames it on the Christians. Here's a guy who decides, hey, nobody likes the Christians. I can win everybody on my side if I go against the Christians. And then what does he do? He finds as many Christians as he possibly can. He kills them. The road leading into Rome, he lines up poles and puts their bodies on the poles to light people's way to Rome. I don't want to go before Nero. Nero is a psychopath, to say the least. But Paul will appear before Caesar. And this is going to show the direction for the rest of the book of Acts. You know, I know Paul doesn't have a death wish, but you know what? I would say, send me someplace else. Send me to anybody other than the Caesars. Well, let me give you a little bit about Festus. There's not a whole lot known about him. All we know is he desired to rule well, and that was his heart's intention. He was, in comparison to all the other leaders, this guy had the intentions of being an honest, righteous ruler. And I mean righteous not in a religious sense, but righteous in a doing the right thing kind of sense. One of the downfalls, however, with him is he wanted to placate the Jews by asking Paul, would you like to go back to Jerusalem? Now, if I was Paul, I probably would have said, yeah, I got the Jews over here, I got Caesar over here. Nobody likes Paul on either end of these spectrums. The Jews definitely want to kill him. I know Nero's a psychopath. What do I do next? I guess I got a better chance with one psychopath than a group of psychopaths. That's the only thing I can think of as far as his rationale is concerned. Now, we've got to keep in mind that as he's getting ready to go before the Caesars, the charges that are being brought against him are extremely serious. In fact, they are so serious, if they are found to be true, Paul will die. Let me ask you a question. What are the charges? What are they saying that Paul has done? Caused a riot? What else?
Breaking the law. I mean, I think they're trying to say that he's not teaching what they're teaching. They don't want that.
How is he breaking the law?
He's not, but they're saying
He's
breaking the law because he actually is teaching it.
Okay. Based on what we've learned so far from the book of Acts. I'm sorry? Well, yeah, for the Pharisees, that would be no big deal. For the Sadducees, it would be a huge deal. But let me ask this question. There we go. Another king. And I'm going to put on here, Lord. The reason why I'm going to put that on there is what we've got is we've got the word Lord or Kyrios. But what's interesting is this. Most of the governors refused to use that word because they did not want to feel like they were above everybody else. They did not want to seem as though they were exalted. The irony is this. Like I said, the governors didn't want to use that. But you know who ended up using it? The Caesars. God was his. Yeah. What I also think is interesting, well, I'm not going to go into that. I look at the little details. When they were trying to trick Christ, and Christ told them, hey, let me see a coin. Now, if you're not into material stuff and you're not supposed to be back during this time, you're a Pharisee, you're supposed to be giving all your possessions to the poor, but you notice what they did? They went right into their clothing, they pulled out a coin. That's crucial, because that tells me what your focus is. If I walk up to you and say, hey, got $100 I can borrow? And he whips out his wallet and pulls out hundreds, that says a lot. Either he's got a really good job, we need to become better friends, or his main focus is the dollar. For them, their main focus is the dollar. It's not worshiping God, it's worshiping man. It's seeing who can be at the top of the ladder. This is the charge that the Romans could execute Paul at. They weren't concerned so much about a riot because they knew better. There's no riot going on there. They're not concerned whether Paul breaks the law. That's unimportant for the king, for the Caesars. But guess what? This is crucial. If I am calling myself Lord and you're worshiping somebody other than me, and it became a law in our province that you worship the Caesar and no one else, guess what? You'll be facing death. On your very last page, I didn't put up on the screen, but on your very last page, I give you a genealogical chart of the Herodian dynasty. So as you see some of the names that are here, you'll be able to point out, oh yeah, now I see who's related to whom, I see who's husband, who's father, and so forth. Because what we have here, we have King Agrippa in the latter part of chapter 25. Now this King Agrippa is actually King Agrippa II. He's the son of Herod Agrippa. We saw Herod Agrippa in chapter 12, verse 1. And he's also the great-grandson of Herod the Great, that was listed in Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. I just want you to keep in mind, when it comes to the Herods, how did the Herods look at Christianity? How did Herods look at Judaism? Anyone remember? How did the Herods look at either Christianity or Judaism? A threat. Let's go back. Matthew chapter 2. I'm going to start off at verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them, "Where the Christ who is to be born?" "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what was written by the prophet." And then he goes on, describes what was written. Verse 7. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from him the exact time when the star was appeared. Let me stop right there for a second. I want you to notice something. These guys knew the prophecy. These guys knew where he was going to be born. These guys knew the time period. They knew all about the star. They knew all about all of this. But, unfortunately, where are the Pharisees in all this? They were the masters of the Old Testament. They were the teachers of the law. If anybody should have been there, it shouldn't have been the Magi. I mean, it shouldn't have been Herod and his cohort. It should have been the Pharisees. Had they understood the Scriptures, they would have accepted Christ right off the bat. Verse 8. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may worship him." Now, a little bit of tongue-in-cheek here. I'm not going to really worship him. He's competition. What do you do with competition? You eliminate them. You think about your roots. The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. You got to be careful. Then we have King Agrippa and his sister Bernice. It's actually kind of funny here because, you know, you would think you've got an occasion like this where the great apostle Paul is coming, that you would want to ask him about what does he believe. They're not concerned about what Paul believes. They want to use this simply as an occasion to display their position, their power, their clothing, their ceremony. That's all they want here. That's all they want because that's how the carnal mind thinks. I want you to notice something else in chapter 25, verses 25 to 27. Let me back up to 24. Festus said, King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man. The whole Jewish community has petitioned me about him in Jerusalem and here in Caesarea, shouting, he ought not to live any longer. I found he has done nothing wrong. Stop right there for a second. Why is that significant? I found he has done nothing wrong. You'll find with Christ, same thing, found nothing wrong. This is the second time that Paul has gone before somebody and they said, I found nothing wrong. You know, you would think after one testimony like that from a governor, another testimony like that, you would just say, release this guy. No. What's interesting is all of this. All of this is still part of God's plan. All of this. I found he has done nothing wrong, deserving of death, but because he made his appeal to the emperor, I decided to send him to Rome, but I have nothing definite to write his majesty about him. Therefore, I've brought him before all of you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that as a result of this investigation, I might have something to write. Now, here we've got one statement. Let me get you to look back two chapters for a second. Because in chapter 23, starting at verse 26, we have an actual letter that was sent. Claudius to His Excellency, Governor Felix, greetings. I'm just going to point out two things. Because I want you to notice, in chapter 25, it was determined that Paul has done nothing wrong. Look at chapter 23, and I want you to notice a couple of things here. The letter says that Paul was seized. The letter says that Paul was rescued. Does it mention anything about Paul being flogged? Paul was flogged by the Romans, but they failed to mention that. Why is that important? Prior to that, Paul was considered innocent. They brought him, they rescued him, they seized him. Over here, Paul is still innocent. What have they done? They have beaten an innocent man. On this side, he's innocent. On this side, he's innocent. In the middle, we've got the beating. That says a lot about our system. It says a lot about our system. And unfortunately, it's true today as well. Now through, you know, we see like a lot of cold case files. We see a lot of CSI type of investigations going on. They've gone back, they looked at all this DNA evidence, they found out, oh my goodness, we've executed the wrong person, or the wrong person's been in jail for 25 years. That's basically what we have here. We have beaten an innocent man. We've beaten an innocent man. Not much has changed through the years. I mentioned earlier the whole aspect of the reason why Paul is on trial. And the reason why they want him executed. For Rome, it's this. For Israel, it's all of this plus some. I told you before that Augustus and Tiberius refused to use those titles. They didn't want to have anything to do with being called Lord because they realized how finite they were. They realized that they're not going to exalt themselves and be called anything even remotely fond of deity. But the Caesars, no. The Caesars were more than happy to use those titles of themselves. Why? Because they wanted to glorify themselves. Remember back, I want to say chapter 10. We have a... I'll tell you one second. Chapter 12. We have one of the Herods stands up, wants to glorify himself. Remember what happened there? Listen carefully. Chapter 12, verse 19. Then Herod went from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there a while. He had been quarreling with the people, Tyre and Sidon. They now enjoyed together and sought an audience with him. Having rescued the support of Blastus, a trusted personal servant of the king, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country and their food supply. On the day appointed, Herod, wearing his royal robe, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people. They shouted, "This is the voice of a god, not a man." Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down and was eaten by worms and died. Makes me wonder whether or not these two other individuals knew about that and decided, no. We heard what happened to Herod. We're not even going to go there. We're not going to go there. God is moving mightily through the book of Acts. Mightily. I mean, on the one hand, I'm like, oh, I wish he was moving like that today. On the other hand, I'm like, oh my goodness, when I think back of chapter 5, I'm glad he's not doing some of the stuff he's doing back then, today. But God is moving mightily here. The church is growing leaps and bounds. Remember the birthing of the church? 3,000, 5,000, 2,000. These are legitimate conversions. This isn't people church hopping. These are people actually becoming Christians for the very first time. They're serving God. And as the book of Acts continues, a lot of these people are going to die for the sake of the gospel. We mentioned, or a question was asked last time regarding some of the groups or some of the teachings out there. And I forgot I had it right here. Let me bring it up for a second so you can kind of have a chance to see. Let's go here. What's being taught out there and by whom? The question more specifically was asked, what is word faith? And who are some of the followers of this group? I'm not going to read off all the names because we simply don't have time. But here's a few I've got. Benny Hinn. I put on here, and I'll explain if you come up and ask me one-on-one. Bill Hybel / T.D. Jakes. Joe Dacherey, Bill Winston, Clarence McClellan, Eddie Long, Casey Treat. I don't know if you remember Casey Treat. He's out of Washington. Red-haired guy. I've got him on tape where he stands up before his congregation. He gets them to chant after him that we are gods. I don't know. I got a problem with that. Charles Finney, Charles Chaps, Criflo Dollar, Earl Polk, Darlene Bishop, Gene Scott. Gene Scott just passed away. Earl Polk, William Kenyon. William Kenyon is significant here because he's actually one of the originals of the Word Faith group. He was a cultist, or correction, an occultist. An occultist who wrote documents, and then Kenneth Hagin stole his writings and put them into Word Faith language. Okay? So people don't realize that what they're actually quoting is somebody that came from a cultic or occultic background. Harold Camping, Gene Scott, Jerry Seville, Jerry Duplantis, I mean, the list goes on and on. John Arnott, Joel Olstein, his dad, John Arnott, John Avanzini, John Hagee, Joyce Myers. I said the list on and on and on and on and on. I think I've got about 150 people. And these are just the big names. This isn't everybody that's out there. That's why, again, I always point out, it's so important to make sure you know what you believe and why. You figure there's probably around 20 really big names out there, but each of those big names averages about 10,000 people in their church, averages another 2 million on the television. Do the math. Any questions? Does everybody have all the acronyms? For next time. No, if you don't have it, make sure you see me. I'll write your name down, make sure I give all the acronyms. So that way you can come up here and say, okay, I'll take this 3-volume set of the Trinity, or I'll take this 2-volume set of Bible Encyclopedia, because I want you to do real, real well. God bless.